I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. News from Iraq this morning, an American soldier has been confined to his barracks in Kirkuk. He's under investigation over the death of an Iraqi man. Not much is known. U.S. soldiers were trying to detain the Iraqi man in an operation to arrest insurgents when he was shot and killed. Well, this shouldn't come as much of a surprise to any of us, given the confusing and dangerous job that U.S. soldiers are being told to undertake in Iraq. They are trained to kill, and they are being told to keep the peace. They are encouraged to mingle with Iraqis as ambassadors of democracy, but now the enemy wears civilian clothing. Earlier this week, American soldiers came under attack when they tried to bring order to the chaotic aftermath of a mosque bombing in Baghdad. All this while, military lawyers and teachers are reviewing their rules of engagement and trying to fight what they call an ethical war under circumstances where the other side isn't playing by the same rules. Is an ethical war even possible in a land of booby traps and suspicion? Can there be clear rules of engagement when the other side is fighting a guerrilla war? And especially when the other side is attacking its own people as a way of whipping up unrest. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And today we'll be talking with a professor of military ethics from West Point and a man training Special Forces soldiers at Fort Bragg. We want to start, though, with one of the military lawyers who has been in Iraq. Colonel Lyle Casey was the senior legal officer advising the 3rd Infantry Division last year in Iraq. He's joining us on the line from the Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. Colonel Casey, good of you to join us.
Thank you, Dick, for having me.
You probably went in your time in Iraq from one ethical dilemma to another moral puzzle in the course of a half-hour period.
That's true. We faced a lot of complex situations, not me personally, although I did a little, but the individual soldier on the street, as you just indicated, faces tremendous challenges. But we do our best to train them to react appropriately.
Tell me about that one night in Al-Hilla, the night when you were taking artillery fire and the commander was looking to you for advice. What happened then?
Let me start, Dick, by explaining my role there.
Sure.
As the staff judge advocate for the 3rd Infantry Division, I was forward with the division commander, and my job was to provide legal advice across the board, but primarily upon our responding to artillery or other attacks against by Iraqi against our forces. In that case, we were receiving some artillery fire from an artillery piece that was located next to a school, in a little playground area next to a school. Now, you may ask how we know that, because they were firing from about 20 kilometers away. The answer is that we have a very sophisticated radar system that will tell us very quickly when a round is in the air, what type of round that it is, the type of gun that it's shot from based upon the size of the radar signature, and then our computers very quickly tell us where it came from using complex algorithms. So we knew within about 30 seconds that a round had been fired, and we plotted it on the map, and we knew that it was coming from next to this school. We also knew that, obviously, the school is a protected place normally. It's one of those targets that we don't take because we discriminate between military and civilian targets. The school was in a residential area as well, so we knew that if we returned fire, we risked causing civilian casualties as well as property damage. In that situation, what we always tried to do was target that or prevent them from hurting U.S. forces in the manner that was potentially the least destructive or caused the least collateral damage. Ideally, that would be if you had forces on the ground that could stop it. Of course, we didn't. We were 20 kilometers away.
Right.
Next choice would be to perhaps get the Air Force, if they were loitering overhead with the right weapon on their aircraft, to target it with a precision-guided missile. In this case, it was 2 o'clock in the morning, and there was nothing overhead that could interdict it. The particular rounds were impacting very close to our division artillery headquarters, which is the command and control center for all of our offensive and defensive fires. So it was a very important target for us.
If these rounds are coming in from 20 kilometers away, these are fairly heavy rounds. You guys are in serious danger at this point. It's worth pointing out.
That's right. These rounds would potentially kill within a 150 yard area. They could kill personnel and they would destroy vehicles and equipment within that wide an area of each individual round, perhaps, because there were large artillery shells. We had nothing in the air that was available to interdict it, and the only weapon system that we had that could reach that far out and hit the target wasn't our tube artillery. It was actually a multiple launch rocket system, which is a rocket artillery. And that particular artillery round has individual bombets that are dispersed. And this is where the ethical dilemma really comes in, because you know that when you drop that type of weapon onto this particular school area trying to kill that piece of military equipment. You're also going to leave those bomblets in the area where they may actually, you know, kill civilians or be left out there for kids to find the next day if they don't go off, because there is, unfortunately, a dud rate of usually 2-3% in this rocket system. Not all the bomblets go off. And so this presents a complex question. You have to evaluate under the law of war how important it is to kill that military target to stop it from hurting your forces. You have to make sure that you don't cause unnecessary suffering. You have to the extent that you can discriminate between military and civilian targets. And finally, you have to do a balancing test to say, is it proportional? Does the military advantage that we gain from this attack, does it outweigh the loss of life or collateral damage that may occur? And that was a very tough call. We had to shoot it, though, because the military target that they were threatening was just too important for the division. Unfortunately, I don't know what happened in terms of the civilian deaths or injuries or collateral damage, because we went on off, you know, towards Baghdad, and this was, I think it was actually a target that was in the outskirts of Al-Hila. So I don't have any firm guidance or understanding of what collateral damage we caused. Obviously, my prayers is it was the least possible.
Now, how much time did you have to make that call?
Probably about 3 minutes. Routinely, we had a procedure set up where we could very quickly look from the computer screen and see where the target was. Prior to the war, we did a lot of work. Not I personally, but the United States Department of Defense did a lot of work. We identified from satellite photos the entire country of Iraq. We had down to the individual buildings on our computer database, and we had prepared in advance 12,000 targets that were schools, mosques, churches, government buildings, and
they were supposed to be restricted,
sites.
Right?
They were restricted
that
targets
plan,
that
right.
We otherwise would not shoot unless we were, you know, had to for self-defense purposes.
I want you to help me with something, and that is explain for me the difference between when you made your decision. You say you were giving legal advice to the commander. I mean, on one hand, I see it as you have to decide, is it the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do? But you put it in legal terms. You're trying to make a legal decision. What's the difference between seeing this under some kind of legal heading and seeing it simply just under, you know, what's right and what's wrong?
Well, if you're asking the greater moral question, I don't know if we can resolve that, because we can only do what's right under the law. I'll maybe give an example later where we chose to do something. We could have done something under the law of war, and we would have been legally justified in doing it, but we chose not to do it. In another instance, I advised the commander, sir, I believe you have authority under the law of war to target this. And he decided, I know I do, but I'm not going to target it, because you're telling me that I could do it and I won't be challenged for it under international law grounds. They won't call me a war criminal if I shoot this round into that city. But, you know, the harm that he's causing me is not sufficient in my mind to make me do that, because I don't want to cause any civilian casualties unless I have to. So there were instances during the war, about 7 times, I think, where I told the commanders, in my opinion, you can shoot this and you'll be safe under international law. And the commander said, great, Lyle, I'm not going to shoot it anyway. And so they made a moral decision, I think.
Right.
In addition to, so it was
with the legal advice that you're providing in the field. Colonel Casey, I want to just hang on for half a second. I'd like to bring Lieutenant Colonel Mike Newton in. He's joining us from a studio in New York. Colonel Newton teaches law at West Point, writes and lectures specifically on human rights law. And, Mike, these are the sorts of questions that you're dealing with almost every day yourself in figuring out rules and ethics of war. Am I right?
Yes, absolutely. I think it's important to realize, and I appreciate Colonel Casey's contribution, that this is not just an esoteric intellectual exercise for our soldiers and commanders. These are very pragmatic, fundamental questions that are in the very fiber of military operations in the current context.
Which is exactly why I wanted to start the program with Lyle's stories. And I want to sort of take that one step further with you, if I can, Colonel Newton, and that is, are there set rules of law? Or do the rules of law change day to day, week to week? I mean, we look at what Iraq was back in April and May, and we look at what it is now. How do we understand how those different balances change? Colonel Newton, go ahead.
Yeah, please. The best that we can do is absolutely teach and practice the core fundamentals, the bedrock principles, among which, for example, Colonel Casey mentioned, is the principle of distinction, that we will never, ever intentionally target civilians or protected property. That principle comes from the law of war. It's a fundamental, absolute imperative. The other fundamental absolute imperative is the right of personal individual self-defense. And then, of course, extrapolating from that, the absolute fundamental duty, the obligation of commanders to provide for the unit self-defense of the personnel under their command. That's their duty. As long as we're restricting ourselves to simply the legal analysis on those fundamental imperatives, it's pretty straightforward. But, of course, these days, in the course of operations that are complex, that are nuanced, what we're asking soldiers to do is to make judgments based on those fundamental imperatives, where sometimes there's not a particular textbook, a school solution, but we teach them the basics, we train them, we put them out, and we ask them to exercise their independence and their judgment to make the best decisions they can under the circumstances.
And Colonel Casey, what happens when you find yourself on a battlefield where on one day you're facing people wearing uniforms, on the next day it's a taxi load full of civilians, and who knows what's in the taxi?
Well, it's very difficult, but I would say at the start of the program you said that soldiers were trained to kill and they were required to keep the peace. That's true to a degree, but we also give soldiers training in crowd control, and sometimes it's very difficult for us as civilians and even as military to understand unless you're in that situation. But we've had the situational training where we put soldiers at checkpoints in training situations. We have role players who come up. And, you know, they'll do something and the soldiers have to react. And then we do an after-action report and say, well, he did this, and what did you see, and why did you do it? And we're doing this education process with the soldiers. So I think that there is training there. We certainly faced that during the war. It was very difficult because the soldiers were told in the beginning, you know, the enemy is the Iraqi regime, and the people that you can shoot are Iraqi soldiers or paramilitary forces. And as we headed towards Baghdad, by the second day, it was pretty clear that the enemy had taken off their uniforms, and we were being targeted by people with weapons who were in civilian clothing. So that made them probably illegal combatants under the law of war, but it presented to us the challenge of, okay, how do you tell a civilian from a civilian combatant? And what if you see someone with a weapon? Do you just target him? And we had to put out some guidance on that. We tried to target civilians with weapons who showed some hostile intent. In other words, they gave some indication they were trying to shoot us, and we looked to see if they were military weapons versus, you know, a hunting rifle or something. In most cases, it was pretty clear. The people with weapons were indeed targeting us, so it wasn't a real problem. But on an individual basis, I mean, I personally, in a convoy I was in, saw civilians toting weapons, and we could have targeted them. And I got on the radio and told the individuals who were performing security for our convoy, you know, to look at them, but because we were in a hurry to move, we passed it off to another unit, so I don't know actually what happened. I'm sure that we tried to target them because there's no question someone carrying an AK-47 and a grenade launcher, you know, has some hostile intent against U.S. forces.
And you're currently a student at the Army War College, so your learning, your relearning of this goes on, I guess.
Yes, it does. It's a great program here. And despite its name, we're not strictly designed to learn how to, you know, fight wars here. It's a much broader strategic leader program.
Which is precisely why we're talking about it today on the program. Colonel Casey, I want to thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Colonel Casey is a judge advocate, as I said, currently a student at the Army War College. We come back after the break. We'll talk more with Colonel Mike Newton. We'll also meet Major Roger Karstens, who is training Special Forces people. We'd like to have you in on this conversation as we all watch through the newspapers and listen to the radio as this war and situation changes so rapidly on the ground in Iraq. How is it that American soldiers can cope with those changes? What are the principles of an ethical war under those changing circumstances? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. About this time last year, in the weeks just before the war in Iraq began, we were doing programs about the ethics of war and trying to make sense of what would happen under circumstances which at that time we could only imagine. Now we know what U.S. soldiers are facing in Iraq. We know how that is changing day to day, and we thought it would be useful to pose the questions again. How do you handle situations in a war zone like that? What decisions should soldiers make? How do they make them? What do you do if you are being targeted by somebody who's in a group full of or in an area of civilians? Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Let's go to Hamburg, New York, and Ray's on the line. Ray, thanks for calling.
Thank you. Colonel Casey was very informative and very enlightening about, you know, what just happens over there. And,
yeah.
I think we're asking our young soldiers to do a very difficult job and put themselves in great risk. And I don't know if I wouldn't be so you know, apt not to shoot first and ask questions later. If put in a situation where I was going to be, you know, very much harm in harm's way, and you know, I think it's a great thing that we ask our boys to do. But how do they make those determinations? It's a pretty tough job.
Colonel Newton, they have that rule of engagement card. Every soldier there has a rule of engagement card in a pocket of his uniform somewhere, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And
of course, in addition to that card, as Colonel Casey alluded to, they receive background training throughout the U.S. military educational system. They've received classroom instruction in the fundamentals and the pragmatics. And then in the context of every deployment, prior to deployment, for both active and reserve forces, they go through a very focused training period. And then in addition, once they're in theater, of course, as Colonel Casey alluded to, there's always legal resources available. There's a great legal support team assembled of lawyers, non-commissioned officers, and soldiers that are always there to help address these kinds of issues as well.
But what about the point that Ray raised? Because I don't think that – I think there are probably a lot of people who are wondering exactly the same thing. Boy, you put me in that situation without knowing – who the enemy combatants are, and the inclination is going to be shoot first, ask questions later. And that goes to the first point that you raised on the program, which is the right of self-defense.
Well, I think that it's very important to understand that what we're talking about is the very backbone of military professionalism and discipline, the disciplined application of force in the context of a command climate that cares very deeply. My phrase is that soldiers, when they go, are ambassadors for freedom. They're the picture of American military professionalism. They're servants of the U.S. constitutional order. Therefore, they carry with them the expectations of an absolute compliance with the law of armed conflict. We're going to do the very best we can do to comply with that in that setting. What we ask them to do, essentially like a battle drill, there are battle drills for ambush where you practice and you practice and you practice and you're trained. And when that happens, you're trained to respond in a disciplined, professional way almost instantaneously. And yes, these are difficult, extremely difficult decisions that we make them, that they're forced to undergo. Mm-hmm. And yet it's the same thing. They rely on their training base. They rely sometimes on their instincts. They rely sometimes on their sight, what they see, what they perceive. And they make the best decision they can under the circumstances. But it's important to realize that we're not just throwing them out and asking them to do that. We've provided a training base for them mm-hmm. that helps them and assists them in making those decisions.
It's a good time to hear from Major Roger Karstens. He's been in the Army 22 years, been a Green Beret since 1991. He's currently in Fort Bragg training soldiers who are heading into Special Forces, and he's joining us on the line. Major Karstens, thanks for being with us.
Hey, thank you for having me, Dick. Appreciate it.
Tell me, when I'm listening to Mike talk about, you know, battle drills and creating that kind of instinctive response, I know that's pretty close to what you're working on, even with these people at the sort of senior level of soldier in the ground. But do those drills, do those notions change as you prepare people to head into places like Afghanistan and Iraq? Are you teaching them something which they might not have been taught 10 or 15 years ago?
You know, I would say yes. We try to make sure that the training is following the situations that we're undergoing. However, I'd say that some of the things that we're facing in Afghanistan and Iraq, you simply have to look back in our American military history, whether it's the 1900s in the Philippines, some time in South and Central America, all the way up to war and post-war during World War II. And this is nothing new to us. We have people that understand insurgency. We have people that understand chaotic and ambiguous environments. And the trick is really to pull on lessons from the past, perhaps take a more, at times, a clinical approach to training, and then ensure that the students have some experiences that they can draw on in their training that they can later apply to the battlefield.
Now, I realize that the drills that you put the Special Forces candidates through are a sort of carefully crafted set that you've put together, and I don't want to look at the questions on the final exam necessarily, but give me a hint of the sort of thing that you'll be asking a soldier to do, someone who's under who you're training now. Give me just a sort of an overview of one type of drill that he or she might be put through.
Well, one that takes place during the Robin Sage Unconventional Warfare Exercise, which is a culminating event for Special Forces soldiers. It's 2 weeks out in the woods of North Carolina,
Yep. Conducted
over a huge part of the North Carolina countryside. And it takes place against the backdrop of an insurgency, where a 12-man Special Forces team links up with a guerrilla unit conducting an ongoing insurgency. And usually at some point during the two-week period, the insurgency will, by script, execute a prisoner or else a member of the local insurgency. And, of course, it's our desire as instructors to observe the students to see if they take the proper actions. Did they try to influence the guerrillas not to do it prior? Did they threaten to withdraw U.S. support if the execution went down? After the execution, did they report it up the proper chains of command? Because we take human rights and the laws of armed conflict very seriously, and it's important for the students to go out and kind of touch some of this. Now, that's one example, and believe me, there are numerous other ones that are scripted and unscripted.
So let me ask you a question that a soldier might ask, just sort of, well, that example's fresh in my mind. Would somebody say to you, Major Karstens, you know, why does it matter? If my life is at risk, or if I think my life is at risk, why do I have to go through this, you know, am I an ethical soldier? Am I an ambassador for democracy? I'm in the heat and the dust and the noise of battle. I don't have time to think about that stuff. What do you say?
I would disagree. You have all the time to think about that, especially prior to going to combat. What you have to understand, and the thing that we really try to get into our students is, you know, you gain your values not so much from an external document like the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, but more so from who you are as an Army officer, and we have our own list of values, or an Army soldier, and also in the American Constitution and in the rules and values that we have as citizens. So how we perform on the battlefield is tied in to our character as individuals. Our own moral compass must be followed. And to, to deviate from that is not right as an American citizen, and I know you expect a lot of us on the battlefield.
Right.
And additionally, if you want to look at it in a little more cost-benefit analysis, to behave in an ethical manner on the battlefield is not only good because we're following our own values that this country believes in, but it gives us some sort of legitimacy in amongst our allies and even the people that we're fighting. If we wage ethical war, we can start to win the tide and have legitimacy on the battlefield, and that's important to us.
Let's go to Medford, Massachusetts. Matt's joining us on the phone from there. Matt, thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
So it seems like a lot of the discussion here has been around snap decisions made on the battlefield. But I'm asking a question more about strategy when you have some insurgents that are embedded in a civilian population over a long period of time and you just can't get rid of them. From a strategic point of view, what do the commanders do in terms of planning raids against people like this? And, I mean, do you have license under international law to be more aggressive about shooting it up and, you know, possibly with a whole lot more collateral damage? Because I don't know how else you're going to get rid of these insurgents. That's my question.
All right. Well, let's hear from both our guests here. Major Karstens, maybe you can give us a sort of ground level first on that, and then to Mike Newton.
All right. Now, by the way, I would like to say hi to Colonel Newton. I'm a big fan of his. I know he does a lot of great work up there at West Point. But, Matt, to answer your question, yes, you do have to go after the insurgents that are blended into the population, and yet, once again, it can be done. You have to have adaptive strategies to go ahead and adapt to your enemy's strategies as well. And I think we're doing that right now. But in taking any battle to the enemy, you always have to be conscious of the rules of engagement, the laws of armed conflict, human rights law, the inherent right to self-defense, and also proportionality. So when you're getting prepared to perhaps conduct a military operation, you have to ask that question, kind of referred to by the first guest, is an attack excessive in relation to the concrete and direct military advantage anticipated? And if you have all those factors in, you can probably plan a good operational strategy that can take the battle to the guerrilla. So I don't really feel it's impossible. And again, you can point back into history where we've done this successfully.
Mike Newton, Matt's question here.
Well, Dick, I think that's a great example. You've got a non-lawyer special forces major from Fort Bragg who just cited legal principle as well as most lawyers could or would. That's a real testimony to the training that's pushed down to soldiers. I think the questioner gets at what we recognize to be an asymmetry of capabilities. In other words, a lot of enemy forces these days can't match us head-to-head with military capacity.
Okay.
Therefore, they resort to what's called asymmetric warfare. And it's important to realize as a start point that mixing into the civilian population, thereby endangering civilians, misuse of civilian property, wearing civilian clothes so that you're not distinguishable from the civilian population, those are all war crimes. So that is an illegal and immoral form of asymmetric warfare that they resort to because they don't care anything about legitimacy and respect for the rule of law. I think it's important to realize that even when we're faced with an asymmetric form of warfare like that, there's never an asymmetry of intent. In other words, there's no moral equivalency between an American soldier who does everything he can do based on his or her training base to comply with the law, to comply with the norms, and yet ultimately, unintentionally, injures an innocent civilian. There's no moral equivalency whatsoever between that soldier who's operating from a disciplined training base, having to use his own initiative, but still caring very deeply about human dignity and compassion and discipline, professionalism in the sense of that setting. There's no moral equivalency at all.
Okay, Colonel,
between him and the person who's in purposefully endangered civilians and purposefully attacked civilians.
Let's go back to Matt and just
intentionally use them.
Matt, are you hearing the answer to the question that you were looking for?
Yeah, these answers are making sense to me, but my question is asking further, is international law clear about what the rules of engagement are under such circumstances where you cannot distinguish between the civilians from the terrorists? And, you know, in particular, I think the Israelis have a huge problem. What would you advise them to do?
Well, the international law, the legal principle is absolutely clear to pointedly answer your question, that you may never intentionally target civilians. What you may do, of course, is always rely on your absolute imperative right of self-defense, which is applied in the context of a pretty complicated mission. Colonel Casey mentioned a very sophisticated legal analysis where they might very well have had the mission flexibility to get at that thing, the enemy target, in other ways other than just attacking it directly. But you may never intentionally attack civilians as such. When a civilian person takes up arms against you, however, he's obviously a lawful target. The question is, of course, for American soldiers who are moral, compassionate human beings, these are fundamentally decent sons and daughters of America. They never want to intentionally harm civilians, and they know there's an absolutely legal prohibition against that. Therefore, the legal rule, really based on common sense, is that you do all that you can do to minimize damage to innocent civilians and property, while always directing your activities against lawful military targets and military objectives. And somebody who's taken up arms against you absolutely is a lawful military target.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. 1-800-423-8255. That's the number to join us at. I wonder, though, Major Carstens, if I can just take Matt's point one step further, and you tell me whether or not this is something that troubles you. If there is an increasing amount of attacking coming from a residential area, or if people figure out that that's the best way to use the asymmetry imbalance that Colonel Newton's talking about. Isn't there a risk that over time it gets easier and easier for American soldiers, American commanders to say, we got no choice. We have to, send deadly firepower into that residential area?
Actually, I disagree. When you take a look at what asymmetrical warfare is all about, one of the great purposes of it is to delegitimize the other side. And if we eventually stoop to that level and eventually decide that we can just go in and do what we want, we've delegitimized ourselves. And therefore, we probably lost that part of the war. So I think it's important that no matter what you're getting in your direction, you have to come up with adaptive strategies to take the battle to the enemy that constantly take into the ideas of the laws of armed conflict, international human rights law, and just, once again, the decency and the values that we all maintain as American soldiers. So really, the short answer is, even though you're receiving increasing pressure in a residential area, that does not give you the right to go in and violate any of the norms that you, as a member of the public, have come to expect from your military services.
1-800-423-8255 to Boston next. Nick is on the line. Nick, thanks for calling.
I just had a question. Everyone has been talking about the moral and ethical applications of military force, but no one has really mentioned yet the fact that the war in Iraq was waged based on the assumption that there would be weapons of mass destruction there. We've waged our first preemptive war on a country based on that threat, and it turned out to be false. So where does that leave the troops in Iraq in terms of engagement, a moral and ethical war? Is it moral and ethical when the war itself was based on a false assumption?
Yeah, Colonel Mike Newton, we have spoken to soldiers who've come back from Iraq and been frustrated with the politics that's well above their head. So I guess at one level, you can't separate big principles like that from the small principles that the soldiers are using on the ground. That's that kind of messy nexus of politics and the military, right?
Well, as a professional matter, the professional and legal norm is absolutely clear that regardless of the purpose for going to war, the professional and legal norms must be applied. And in fact, going back to the previous question, I think it's very important to realize that our professional standards and the expectations of the American people don't change regardless of the conduct of the enemy. Those are our legal obligations to comply with the law, and therefore it's incumbent upon us to have a training base that complies with the law and does the best to equip, to give our soldiers the right training base to do the right thing, no matter what the enemy is doing, no matter what the cause for going to war. Those, at the very point in the instantaneous decisions that soldiers have to make, all those tangential peripheral considerations really become irrelevant, because in the heat of the moment, in the midst of fear, in the midst of chaos, with the adrenaline going, he has a very quick decision to make, and he's making that based on the confluence of the tactical situation, the larger strategic situation, the overarching backdrop of legal norms, mm-hmm. and the fact, talking to a lot of soldiers, they're very conscious of the fact that they wear an American flag on their shoulder, and they want to represent the values and the principles of U.S. military professionalism. So all those background factors fall away.
Part of the values of U.S. The U.S. military abroad is to be representing the United States Constitution and to fall into adherence in some ways with international law. And it would seem that the war in Iraq may have been out of step with both of those if there was a misrepresentation about weapons of mass destruction there. And that was our cause for being there. So I just wonder how that affects the act of applying American force in Iraq, whether or not it can be an ethical or a moral thing to do.
Nick, I want to thank you for that point, and I'll have Colonel Newton and Major Carson just hang on for half a second. We have to step away and take a short break, but we will come back at that question when we return. And Connection listeners, I invite you in on this conversation. We're at 1-800-423-8255, examining the nature of ethical war as this one changes in the way that we're watching it change in Iraq. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. With me on the program this hour, Lieutenant Colonel Mike Newton. He's in the West Point faculty, in the law department there, an expert in human rights law, and Major Roger Carstens is with us. He's currently training soldiers going into the Special Forces. And, Roger, maybe I can just go back and give you a crack at Nick's final point, the idea that if the ethics or the morals of the very war itself are thought to be flawed or in question, whether or not that challenges you, somebody trying to imbue those ethics and morals into the soldiers who are going over to fight that war.
Yeah, my own answer, I'll stay within my pay grade. I'd love to answer that at a higher level, but just not making that much money to do that right now. But, you know, as the man on the ground, your job is to execute the war and prosecute it ethically, regardless of what the higher-level circumstances. You know, policy makers and strategy implementers have their own set of challenges, be they moral, be they logistic, et cetera. But for the guy who's on the ground, who's forced to deal with whatever decisions the policymakers made, your mission's clear, and that is to make ethical decisions, and when waging war, do so ethically.
And, Colonel Newton, let me come back to something that you said a couple of moments ago. I just made a scribble on my notebook because I wanted to check this with you. You said that the expectations of the American public do not change, that they are constant in what they expect of the American soldier. And at the level of, you know, wherever the ethical or moral bar is set, I'm with you completely on that. But I wonder if we look at the combat in Iraq over the past year, whether or not we haven't seen the public expectations ricochet up and ricochet down. I mean, at some point when they're booby trapping the garbage bags and the you know, trash bins at the side of the road, and these kids who are over there trying to help out, trying to fix telephones and stuff like that, are taking it. I'm hearing people, in the States saying, forget it. Why bother with this? You know, and at that point, their expectation is way, way down.
Well, I want to go back to Nick's point just briefly and focus what we're talking about is the tactical level decisions that soldiers make.
Right.
And in fact, they make those decisions within the context of a mission. It's a very important principle that our moral authority and the degree to which we train and comply with the law of war is an absolutely indispensable central element of what we do on the ground. And as a matter of formal military doctrine, you know, at any level of command, when you're planning for your mission, you have specific tasks you have to accomplish. And so you plan, of course, for what the mission is and what the enemy capabilities are and what the troops available and the time and those other factors. One of those factors is the interface and the interaction with the civilian population. And I stand by what I said. I mean, I absolutely believe that the American public, as a central tenet of American military professionalism, expects us to comply with the law. We are not an undisciplined, renegade, undisciplined rabble. We are a professional military force, and a key aspect of our, we call it a force multiplier, a key aspect of accomplishing our mission is, in fact, the moral legitimacy and the moral authority that we bring, even to a complicated, chaotic, dusty battlefield where the adrenaline is high and the fear is high. We still have a training standard that expects those personnel and those commanders not just to disregard the norms of the law, but to do the absolute best they can to comply with those norms based upon a training base,
right,
and based upon a very obvious, as you noted earlier, an incomplete database of intelligence and information, and sometimes a very small, finite amount of time to make those decisions. I believe the American people still expect us to do our absolute dead-level best in those circumstances. And you'd be amazed. Let me give you one story from Nasiriyah. I mean, a lot of these things, as you alluded to earlier, there are no textbook. I can't hand somebody a 3x5 card and say, here's your answer. What we can do is we can train the principles, we can train the law, and then we release them to use their independence and their initiative and their judgment and their professionalism. We had a commander in Nasiriyah who's outside a mosque, whose troops were threatened. There was a very hostile crowd. There began to be rocks. There were some weapons. And if you just looked at the basic principles of distinction, well, his soldiers were threatened. And the basic inherent right of individual self-defense and the basic duty of a commander to defend his soldiers, the entire unit, you could have made an argument that they were perfectly within the lawful authority to use force against that crowd. What this commander did, in the blink of an eye, made a decision to have his soldiers turn away from the mosque, go to one knee, point their weapons at the ground, and simply smile at the crowd. That's the kind of independence and judgment and integrity and snap decisions that we're asking commanders and soldiers to make. And it in that case, had the desired operational effect of lowering the hostilities. It accomplished the mission in a way that was perfectly in compliance with the legal norms. There are other situations
let me stop
where,
you there because
where that
I
may
wanna,
not be so clear.
I want to get back to our callers. I remember that story. I'm glad you reminded me of it. 1-800-423-8255 to Winchester, Massachusetts. Harold's on the line. Harold, thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call, and good morning. I think this is an outstanding show, as usual. I wanted to make two points. I hesitate to use the word rebuttal, but just to your caller before the break, I'm a Vietnam veteran. And I think that, with due respect to the caller, it's unfair to assign to the warrior in the field managing a political decision which was made at the highest offices in the United States. I mean, we, regrettably, coming back from Vietnam, were smeared as baby killers and all sorts of unfair comments because of an unpopular war. So I hope that the sense is going to be to continue to move away from that sort of practice. Secondly, I was 8 months in the field and then 4 months as a civil affairs officer in the Coastal Plains 35 years ago. And civil affairs, and I see this discussion this morning about legalities and whatnot as part of a civil affairs issue. It really wasn't. Civil affairs was not as big a priority in those days as it is today, and I'm delighted to see this change in mindset within the military. And those are my two points. And
no, don't go anywhere, Harold, because I'm interested in your own perspective on the conversation, what you're hearing from Mike and Roger here in terms of whether or not you see soldiers today better equipped, better trained, better aware of these legal issues, these moral issues.
All of the above.
Yeah?
All of the above. I remember when I was in OCS, I made a presentation about about how the American soldier had always been viewed as a hero and not a conqueror, but as a liberator. And other than that one class, I don't recall that we spent. And I was only, a junior officer. I mean, this wasn't commanded general staff college. But there wasn't anywhere near as much of a priority on these items. And obviously there is now. And I think that's outstanding.
Harold, I want to stop you there and move along. I thank you for your call. We've actually got another Vietnam vet joining us on the line from Pittsburgh, Massachusetts. Ed is with us now. Ed, what's your point?
Okay. Yes, good morning. I'm a disabled veteran from Vietnam. I'm a survivor of Agent Orange, and I worked in the air war in Vietnam, computerized warfare. And in the beginning of your show, you mentioned anti-personnel weapons being dropped near a schoolyard in a place called Azeed, Iraq, I believe. I want to talk about anti-personnel weapons and our use of them in Iraq. I was horrified by the Shock and Awe campaign. I haven't watched television since. I saw something on CNN that just horrified me when I heard they were dropping anti-personnel weapons. And weapons in our arsenal, some of them are very horrible, especially anti-personnel weapons.
Ed, let me just stop you there and ask you, in context of today's conversation, are you saying that it's hard to talk about the morals of war and what the soldiers themselves are taught to do when some of the weapons are, such as the ones that you were talking about, anti-personnel weapons?
Yes, this is true, because these anti-personnel weapons, they were designed so some of them had plastic shrapnel in them. They were designed so they couldn't be detected by X-ray or MRI, and a lot of the medical people had a hard time dealing with the civilian population after the war in Vietnam, dealing with the medical problems of people that had these flechettes in their limbs and this kind of shrapnel.
Okay, Ed, I want to stop you there. I think it's a great point, and I'd like to hear my guest on that. Just a reminder to our listeners, you're listening to The Connection from NPR. And Colonel Luton, just the sort of overall point about the balance of weapons and how that fits into a moral equation. Help Ed with that one.
Well, thank you, Dick, for the opportunity to answer that. That's one of those fundamental bedrock principles and legal norms that I mentioned. As a basic principle of the law of armed conflict, that it's absolutely unlawful to use weapons that he alluded to. There's none of those weapons in the U.S. Army inventory that I'm aware of that have plastic rounds and that are undetectable by medical equipment, because that's a fundamental violation of the laws of war. What we do for our soldiers is we give them the best equipment in the world. For every piece of kit that's issued, for every piece of gear, every weapon, there's an exhaustive legal review that's done so that we can absolutely guarantee them this weapon is per se lawful under the laws of war. Now the obligation is upon you, the user, to use it in a lawful way. Mm-hmm. Getting back to the principles that we've talked about distinction and discrimination, to help them do that. And one of the changes over the last 15 or 20 years is that we've been more successful in building in the legal teams at all levels of command. So there's, throughout the mission planning and the operational process, there's legal talent available to help that. When you juxtapose that with the training base and very, very high quality of commanders that are in the field, we feel like that's we have the obligation to give them the best equipment in the world. We're also giving them some of the best training in the world to understand and be able to use that equipment properly, even in the context of these very difficult circumstances.
Let me go back to the call, if I can, to this one's from Fort Bragg. And who is it on the line?
Yeah, I'm from Fort Bragg. I don't want to disclose my name.
Are you in the military, sir?
Yes, I am. I just got back from Iraq. I spent the past year there, and I had a question. I felt as if that we weren't using enough aggression. I kind of felt like a sitting duck at times, and so did my soldiers. And I felt if we used more aggression, that we hit the areas that were hitting us, because we kept on getting attacked by the same areas. And all we would do is sit there and wait to be mortared or be attacked by an IED on the side of the road. I felt that a lot of soldiers are dying because we're not using enough aggression. I want to know how they felt about that.
If you had been allowed to be more aggressive, are you saying that you could have stopped a lot of the attacks?
I think if we use more aggression, maybe they wouldn't be so quick to attack us.
Major Karstens, this man is just back from Iraq. What would you say to him?
That's a real hard one, and I'll tell you why it's hard. It's hard to, you know, I'm sitting here honestly with a cup of coffee in an air-conditioned office, and having not been on the ground that his commanders were on and not understanding the political, economic, and social implications of warfare in that specific area, it's hard for me in the comfort of this office, not knowing the external factors, to really offer anything on that one. I would dare say that I have a lot of faith in the commanders that they're executing a good strategy overall, and the reason I do so is because they go through some of the same training that I've been through. It's aggressive military training, and at the same time, you know, as I'll keep harping, it has a very strong human dimension to it. So, you know, I wish I could say more, but not having been in his position, it's really almost immoral for me to comment.
Though, Colonel Newton, I mean, it's certainly a valid point of view for him to express.
Well, absolutely, from the perspective of a frustrated soldier, it's one of the difficult human dimensions that we ask our soldiers to do. Is even when they're taking casualties, even when the enemy is willfully violating the law of war, the professional standard is still that our soldiers will comply with the laws of war no matter what.
Which he did.
The way we say
he just said he was frustrated by it.
And what I would say in response to that, again, it's very difficult for me from this perspective to know the details and precisely respond. In that circumstance, I would say that the soldiers and the commanders in the field, where they're spotting a tactical gap, or something in the rules of engagement that's unclear, to raise that through command channels. Those are commander decisions, but it's important to realize that commanders make those decisions based on the guidance and principles of the law. The lawyers don't make those decisions. Commanders make those decisions. It's our job to advise, and that's the kind of thing that Colonel Casey was talking about.
Right.
Sometimes, in the context of an overall mission, even when the law of war gives you authority to do something, the commander has perfect discretion not to do that, and that's a commander's decision.
Always interesting to listen to the kind of legal thinking and ethical puzzling that goes on behind the scenes. Colonel Mike Newton, I want to thank you for being with us on the program today.
Thank you very much, Dick.
Colonel Newton is at West Point, and U.S. Army Major Roger Karstens from Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Dick. Appreciate it.
A little earlier in the program, we talked with Colonel Lyle Casey, who was Senior Legal Officer advising the 3rd Infantry Division in Iraq. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.